Happy Friday, everyone. We are convening today's Revenue Committee, and we are going to open continue the public hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 2328A. For the record, you want to remind us what this is, Mazin?
Chair Berger, we can do that. I think today it's to note that this is the proverbial tax day, but it's not.
Okay. Yes.
Yes.
Monday's actual. Unless you're a business, which is today.
House Bill 2328A is the bill that is the contains the idea of having the payments for vehicle miles or miles driven on the highway charged by the mile rather than by the instrument of propulsion, which is fuel tax or diesel. So this is for the light vehicles, primarily for the new types of vehicles that are coming on the road, which are electric and hybrid electric and don't necessarily have the instrument to pay for the tax or for the road construction and maintenance as constitutionally mandated.
Thank you, Mazin. I think what we're going to do is we're going to hear testimony from folks, Dave Reinhart specifically, who was here yesterday and didn't get a chance to speak. And then we're going to bring up the technicians. Okay. And Gary, are you with ODOT?
No, I'm the organizer of this association.
Would you like to come up too? And then we're going to bring up our technical people back because I think there's a lot of technical questions that didn't get answered yesterday from the committee. So Dave and Gary.
Good morning, co-chairs Berger and Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Dave Reinhart, public affairs counsel here today representing General Motors. In opposition to 2328A. I wanted to associate myself with the remarks of Mr. Cosgrove yesterday, who I thought made a very compelling presentation on why we shouldn't go forward at this time and that we really in this case need more study on the part of all the actors, all the state actors involved in this larger issue. We believe that the electric vehicles and other alternative fuel vehicles should ultimately pay their way. We believe in equity, but just not at this time. Now, a lobbyist asking for more time to study an issue can elicit some skepticism, even on the most bright-eyed, on the part of the most bright-eyed legislator. I'm reminded of St. Augustine's prayer, make me chase, but not yet. But we believe there's a reason to delay the decision in this on this new tax. We believe your decision needs to be looked at in the context of the plug-in electric vehicle and alternative fuel tax credits that are up for discussion right now. And we believe they should be looked at in tandem. Oregon has worked to be a leader in electric fuel adoption and development of electric vehicles and other alternative fuel vehicles. We believe this bill would undermine that. Now, imposing a new tax on plug-in vehicles as you extend the tax credit for plug-ins and fueling stations, I think would be a confusing policy at best and somewhat incoherent at worst. As I said, we've worked hard to become a leader, and this has been recognized. This is a policy, I think, that is succeeding slowly. It is a very immature technology right now, and we're not talking about a great deal of money here. Obviously, we wouldn't contend that on the part of either the tax credit or the increase for the road use. But I think it would send a very confused signal. I mean, are we going to are we working to put our policies in sync with one another? We think that as you sunset that tax credit for EVs, plug-in EVs, that then you should move to a tax system. But to do one as you extend the other works at cross purposes, and we believe it sends the wrong signal. There are, we think, many equities involved, and as you saw yesterday, it's just not a matter of the plug-in EVs pulling their share of the weight. There are other vehicles that are heavier, other vehicles that may get better mileage, and you want to work that out. Moreover, I think you want to work out how the state positions itself in terms of its outreach to manufacturers, its outreach to the federal government. I mean, we've gained a fair amount of federal investment under the stimulus bill, and we've done it because we are a leader, and we have positioned ourselves, and it has worked. Again, the dollars involved are small, but we think the signal you would send in the end would be rather large at this point. And that signal would be that Oregon is not serious, or at least it's confused about becoming a leader in electric vehicle use technology and manufacturing. Thank you. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Reinhart? Thank you. Welcome.
Should I?
Just hand them right there to that. And if you'd give us your name, just your name for the record when you start.
I'm Gary Gronke.
And say whatever it is you came to tell us.
Okay. Well, it turns out that last night was a regularly scheduled Oregon Electric Vehicle Association meeting.
Okay.
And it was a wonderful one. We had five Leafs and a Volt there. First store-bought EVs we've ever seen at our meetings. So, but it was rather late, and so I tried to summarize. We had a little discussion about this bill because we've had a lot on our listserv, and of course, and when everybody's there in person, it makes it a little easier to make progress. So I'm trying to summarize this. Some of our feelings, some of them are the group feelings. I'll try to distinguish between my own personal feelings and that of the group, which is very hard to represent. We're a very diverse group. But I was doing this at 4 a.m., so if things don't seem quite grammatically correct, I apologize. So first of all, I've been an electric vehicle driver for the last 10 years. I would have wanted to be one in the 70s when we stood in line for 4 hours to get 10 gallons of gas. But the only vehicles available were a golf cart, roughly, that didn't go very fast, and another one that cost more than my house. So, of course, in the 90s, California helped us along by getting us to try real electric cars from real auto manufacturers with real range exceeding 100 miles. Okay. First of all, we don't even think about the road tax. We're certainly not doing EVs to avoid the road tax or anything. The amount of money I've spent on my EVs, I could have had a Tesla. And so those batteries have been extremely expensive. The ones I have are 5 years old, and they cost four times what it costs in the Leaf. So those costs are coming way down. Every 5 years, they get cut in half. But we're still not quite there yet. So people still would not... The main obstacle is the large initial cost, which the federal and state tax credits definitely help get us going and get us bootstrapped. But eventually, of course, Nissan expects to make money on the car with no subsidies at all and still price it competitively. Okay, so some of our members like to link it to the miles per gallon equivalent, but I personally prefer just to say that we don't care what kind of fuel it is that we have. But the road does recognize the weight of the vehicle. That does have impact on road maintenance, and also the speed at which we hit those potholes make a big difference in terms of the cost of maintenance. I think a lot of us were very comfortable with the notion of fairness, that if you take a particular vehicle and find a very close or the same vehicle in a gas vehicle, fairness means we should pay the same amount of tax as for that vehicle. So to say all EVs are getting 20 miles per gallon is not very good. I have a motorhome that gets 20 miles per gallon. It's obviously going to pay more than a very small car. And many of the cars that we have now are small cars simply because we can't afford batteries for big cars. There are electric Humvees. The batteries cost an awful lot of money. So to get the range we want, we tend to be driving these little tiny cars right now, but that's simply a matter of the battery costs being very high. So right now, the vehicles that you would find comparing to EVs like a Yaris, it's going to be getting 40 miles per gallon at least, even as a straight gas car. It's not in the same category. So we think that a weight consideration should be added to the mile thing, or at least different vehicle categories based on weight could distinguish some of the smaller, more cars that have less road impact. Again, not talking about fuel efficiency, just talking about road impact from the larger one. As far as collecting the tax, we're happy to make estimated tax payments or something like that. If it works for the IRS, we think it would work there. But we hope that you can come up with some low-tech ways that won't cost the department a lot of money to do. But we think it is prudent to work in the long term. I mean, Warren Buffett may be right. Right now there's only a couple of us, but in 20 years he's saying all vehicles will be electric based on declining petroleum production. I don't know if he's right or not, but there's certainly going to be a lot of electric vehicles as there was the majority of electric vehicles 100 years ago were electric. So. Okay, I tried a flat fee. We used to have a flat fee. My first EV cost me an extra $30 because I don't buy gas, right? So, but unfortunately, they were lead batteries, and we could only drive them 20 miles or maybe 50 miles if it was a pickup truck full of batteries. So that's not very far, and with range like that, you really can't go more than about 3,000 a year, even if you're trying very hard, because you have to stop and charge all the time. One other minor point is the confiscation and auctioning seems a little drastic. Why could you not renew our registration, which would prevent us from driving the vehicle on the road if we're not up to date on the tax? And you can add penalties and interest and whatever, but it seems like somebody wants a cheap Tesla here. That's just how it strikes us. I'm sorry. I don't know if there's a comparable thing for gas cars or not. So. Finally, one factor to consider, we don't know really when you want to start doing it. Clearly, you want to be ready. You might want to wait till there's enough of them to make it worthwhile, certainly enough to cover your costs. You don't really want to lose money spending it trying to collect a tax that's not very much money for a while. And finally, another factor might be that even today, despite our best efforts and lots of federal funding, we still cannot go very many places in Oregon. So I've made trips to Lincoln City, to car shows and so forth from Hillsboro. And yes, we charged up at casinos and RV parks and businesses. It's an adventure. And until it's boring and routine, like it is with a gas car, then we have to say that we're not really getting our fair use of the roads in Oregon. We don't have an ability to use the roads to the same extent that a gas car does. So we're hopeful that will change really soon. Um, but But it's a little premature to worry about us paying for something we can't really use. So so I think that's it. We're happy to pay our fair share. Some of us have this radical idea that we might even want to pay a little more as long as it helps build those funds that are dedicated to building the infrastructure out to make our electric vehicles more valuable to us.
Thank you, Mr. Gronsby. Questions? Mr. Bernanke. Oh, well, I have one. How many were at that meeting last night, and what representative number of EV vehicles were in the room? Must have been fascinating.
We had about 50 or 60 people. It gets to be a lot more in the summer. Obviously, a lot more people come out in the fair weather than in the rain. Let's see, we had probably about four or five conversions there. Again, the five Leafs and a Volt were the stars of the show.
Well, thank you very much for coming, and thank you for your testimony, both
thank
of you.
You.
And Larry Winarski has joined us. Please come forward. Just give your name and your testimony.
My name is Larry Winarski, and
sorry.
I am unfortunately, I wasn't able to drive my electric car here because it's just outside of my range. I really wanted to. I can get here, but I can't get back. So, you know, it's kind of somewhat humorous. I was going to make a testimony as to why, you know, the electric car usage isn't a really big problem. I kind of had prepared notes here. We live on a finite planet. If you take all the land on the entire planet and divide it by the world's population, you only have 5.2 acres per person. It's very small, and it's getting smaller every day. That's only 226,000 square feet. That's a square 475 feet across. It's about the size of a city block for each person on the planet. And on that block, you have to grow all your own food, all your steel, all your energy, all your wood, and we've been sucking the oil out of that block for 100 years, and it's getting harder to find. Now, about every 3,000 blocks, there's a guy who isn't using his oil. Instead, he is working hard, trying to invent a way that we can all stop using oil and instead use electricity, perhaps generated from 20 or so solar panels. His car is very expensive and small, and it has a lot of limitations and doesn't go very far very fast, but it's getting better, and he's trying hard to do the right thing. So how should we reward this unsung hero? Should we give him a medal? Should we cheer him on for saving our butts and the environment? Or should we instead worry that he's using our roads to experiment on free of charge and getting a free ride along with bicycle riders? Here's Webster's definition of petty. It's characterized by an undue concern for trivial matters, especially in a small-minded or spiteful way. Currently, there are at least 3,000 gas cars for every electric car. That means 99.97% of cars are gas and pay gas tax. And furthermore, virtually 100% of EV drivers also have a gas car and do pay gas tax. And I can safely guarantee that not one single person built or bought their electric car to get out of paying road tax. We have a long, long, long way to go before we have any problem with the gas tax. And we have the time to do the electric car tax right when it is necessary and will actually generate money for roads. Our cars are getting more economical, and that's a good thing. And that doesn't mean we have to have less revenue for the roads. It just means that the person is actually saving money, and we can have more, a little bit more money for roads if we just raise the rate, gas tax rate, and the person will be paying exactly the same tax as he was before, and he'll still be saving money. And the person likely won't even notice that he's paying a nickel more because that is slightly more than 1% of the cost of gas. And with more electric cars and fuel-efficient vehicles on the road, the gas price will likely go down because of decreased demand. That could conceivably mean you could raise the tax rate as the price was falling, and the cost per gallon would be even less than it was. So I just can't really think that, you know, worrying that the sky is falling and we're not going to have road revenue because a very small percentage of the cars or electric cars or economical cars, I just can't see it. you know, eventually, and, you know, I really hope this happens, we will have enough electric cars, and we can actually worry about making them pay for the roads. And we can use the petroleum they didn't use for asphalt and things like that. I really think the gas tax is a great thing, and it's been great. The average person virtually forgets he's paying it. He buys gas, and it's a relatively small part of the bill, and he pays it in the state that you're currently driving. So if a Californian drives across Oregon, he pays tax in Oregon and doesn't think about it. And it works on a lot of other levels. It encourages conservation. Bigger cars and trucks use more gas, and they pay more tax. The motorcycle damages the road very little, and it pays less tax. I really believe we can do the same thing with electric cars. It is no harder to monitor electricity usage for charging than it is to monitor the odometer in a car. Furthermore, the electric utilities are already looking very heavily into monitoring and controlling appliances to spread out electrical usage throughout the day. This would dovetail very nicely into electric car charging system with a tax built into it. This system could easily be read by the meter reader at the same time he reads the normal meter. Furthermore, we already have widespread remote meter reading technology. My dad has 3 meters, and all of them transmit their usage to consumers' power. And also, for a family that have multiple cars, they could pay a single tax bill seamlessly collected by the utility. We wouldn't have to worry about people not paying the road tax bill and confiscating their cars, and because it would be done virtually invisibly. And we'd all have happy taxpayers, and you'd all be heroes. And this would be great for public charging stations, too. We can collect tax from Californians and Washingtonians using our public charging stations and use the money for our roads. Likewise, they can do the same for us. Furthermore, if you had a little bit of a surcharge at the public charging stations, we can fund more public charging stations, which EV people would really like and be perfectly willing and be ecstatic to be paying for it. And, how many times do you hear that about a tax? And this could all be done seamlessly without excess paperwork, draconian enforcement, suspension of driving privileges, confiscation of cars, and you wouldn't require another bill to pay. We have time to do this right. We're not in any giant crisis for for road tax from EV users. It's a very small amount. Virtually 100% of EV users also have a gas car and are paying tax for long trips. We aren't in any desperate situation and are not likely to be one in for a decade. We have time to do this right. The current bill seems like it has a lot of problems. It's been changed a bunch of times from 0.6 cents a mile, which is a 50 mile per gallon equivalent, to 1.43 cents, 21 mile per gallon equivalent. And it also allows 5,000 non-electric cars to opt in. I don't see how that makes any sense. It expects you to give them virtually a blank check for any technology they want to develop over the next several years, and doesn't even bring in enough revenue to cover costs for a long period of time. And I guess I urge you to ask ODOT to reconsider this and look maybe at a charging solution for tax.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Winiarski? Thank you for coming. I just have to comment about those happy taxpayers you talked about. They rarely come into this room. We hear from the other ones a lot. But thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate you coming down, and I'm sorry you couldn't bring your electric vehicle. Anyone else that wants to speak? I think I'm going to call our ODOT representatives to come up, and we kind of cut off technical questions yesterday of this panel, and so now, committee members, are there any further things that you guys want to talk about first that have come up between yesterday and today's testimony that I'd like to hear whether, specifically, whether there was discussion, for instance, in the previous committee on the penalty piece and whether that's appropriate, and any other questions of the committee. Do you have any?
Chair Berger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Whitty, manager of the Office of Integrated Partnerships and Alternative Funding at ODOT. I just have the comment on the seizure issue that just came up. No longer in the in the engrossed bill. It was removed by the Transportation Committee.
Thank you. What are the the usual tax penalty? Are there no tax penalty in the bill?
Oh, yes. There's a fair amount of... The tax penalties were, as I understand it, Maureen knows more than I do about this, but were taken from a mature tax statute, which is the diesel tax, and then pulled over and then adjusted a bit for this bill. And so it has many, many different ways to ensure compliance. But Maureen, would you like to go through those?
Yes. For the record, my name is Maureen Bach. I'm the Fuels Tax Program Manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Chairs, members of the committee, originally the bill mirrored the Fuels Tax Statute, which has two components, motor vehicle fuel and a used fuel tax component. Originally, the bill was written with a 10% penalty provision, which would mean a very low penalty on the usage for these vehicles. And the Road User Fee Task Force then amended that to comply, I believe it was the Road User Fee Task Force. But anyway, they changed that provision, so it now has a $25 penalty. So that would be more in line with something that would drive compliance for the first instance of non-payment, and then $50 thereafter.
Okay.
More than that. I believe there's more penalty provisions than that's just one.
Oh, there's also an interest component. It's 1% per month, and
on the unpaid balance.
On
of
the unpaid balance, and then there was also the ability to suspend driving privileges for non-payment.
Representative Brewer had her hand up first, so I'm going to take him in the order, and we're going to open this for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We talked yesterday in my office, too, and I have some concerns on the collection model and the enforcement. I think there's a lot of rework that needs to happen as the bill is as provided, and you had mentioned some flexibility towards working towards that. The penalties need to have a maximum penalty amount applied. The interest, I didn't review that yet, but we need to discuss, is that just the unpaid balance, or is it the unpaid balance plus penalties? The interest rate is that in conformity with where we are on other interest rates for unpaid liabilities in our tax system. But we need to make sure we're somewhere driving with it. But then I also believe, and asked if you can speak to it a bit more, the suspension of the driver's license for failure to pay seems to me a disconnect from the car. It, for lack of a better word, the sin and the sinner are somehow disconnected there in my mind. I'm not sure how to get back to creating it in line, but it's troublesome to me. I don't understand why we wouldn't just simply not renew the car or the ability to renew it. The owner of the car is not necessarily the person driving it, and so that is problematic for me for enforcement. And I'd like to maybe explore other options that may be more palatable, maybe more direct cause and effect. And that's the enforcement and collection side, the frequency as well of the reporting and the reporting model. Is there? But I did ask also if they could opine. Yesterday we received a letter with an amendment from Drive Oregon, a suggested amendment, and I wanted to get your feedback on that. And that seems to go towards market penetration for creating raising the rate at a certain level of market penetration.
Okay. Those are your issues?
My issues and then their feedback on the amendment that we got yesterday, suggested amendment.
Okay.
I can opine on the interest because that is what we currently charge on delinquent accounts. So that actually mirrors what is in our current fuels tax statutes. That 1% per month is exactly the same interest rate.
Penalties too?
And it does not apply to penalties. Okay. It's just on the unpaid balance. Because penalties are waivable and interest is not. Okay. It's the way those statutes are written. So for good cause, you can waive penalty for, you know, acts of God or whatever. There's a whole laundry list of things that constitute reasonable cause for non-payment.
Chair Berger, Representative Brewer, I don't recall seeing the amendment from Drive Oregon. I remember hearing the amendment he was discussing yesterday. I must say it's an intriguing ideas that he was putting forth. I can tell you that ODOT is interested in a bill that can achieve the necessary votes for passage. And so, but
well put.
There's another concern that hasn't been raised yet, and that is we want to be able to operate the system in the black as soon as possible, rather than operate in the red, because that means the gasoline and diesel vehicles will continue to subsidize these, maybe at a lesser amount, but they will continue to subsidize these electric vehicles. So that's just a department concern. But the idea of taking some time to reach the full rate is an intriguing idea.
Thank you. I have a series of questions sort of on fundamental things. I'm sure you went over all of this in the Transportation Committee, so forgive me for raising them again. You talked a little bit yesterday about the reporting issues. You mentioned an onboard diagnostic system that already exists, at least in some of these cars. You talked about wireless connections from odometers as a way of measuring things. Today we heard from Mr. Winiarski, who had a suggestion for how you collect the tax just based on fees at public charging stations, which is in at least intriguing for me and probably reduces your costs because it's all electronic at that point, and it would just be part of the fee you pay when you charge up. You wouldn't pay it, obviously, when you charge at home, unless the electric power company had managed to set up their smart grid system, and then they could collect it as part of their electric bill to the house. But I'm interested in hearing what you know today about how these systems are going to be set up, or how they're set up, what kind of agreements there are among manufacturers and the government, if any, whether there are any standards, either private standards that everybody's following or public requirement standards around these issues that we're discussing about how you might collect some kind of a charge, either for the use of the electricity or for mileage or something else. What are those things that are now, that we have now, or that are in the works that are going to happen?
Yeah. Chair Berger, Co-Chair Barnhart, raised a lot of issues there. I'll try to hit all of them.
It seems to me this is an absolutely key item.
Yes.
If we're going to actually enforce this kind of thing, you don't want to get, I'm going to tell you what I'm thinking about, and then please answer. But I don't think you can get to a tax that people will willingly pay if you say they have to send you a check every 90 days, or if you say we're going to collect it as part of your income tax return next year, or any of those kinds of things. I think you've got to figure out a way to collect it when they buy fuel, like we do now. Now, it may not be based in the same way. It may be based on mileage, like you do for big trucks and so forth. But I think if we're actually going to get to a much larger use of either electric-based vehicles or other alternate fuel vehicles, we're going to have to figure out a way to do it pretty automatically, very much the way Mr. Winiarski suggested a few minutes ago.
The idea of charging for electricity has come up in recent years only. It is more problematic than you might think. And in fact, if we had a bill to do that here, we probably wouldn't be hearing from the auto manufacturer. We'd be hearing from the utilities about the difficulties of that. Electricity can be obtained in many, many ways, and it doesn't have to be the owner who supplies it. It could be the neighbor or any such person. So, and the person does not have to visit an electric vehicle charging station to get electricity. So these are the problems. I understand very well the idea of collecting at a point of purchase. Mm-hmm. That was what the original pilot project did, and it was to make it easy, and we could monitor it and keep make sure that it happened. Electric charging stations, however, are something that may be visited Well, if somebody wanted to avoid the tax, they could avoid it altogether, depending on how they drive. So electricity is a more difficult way to tax. What we have done, ODOT, and it also in my little office, we're working on the electric vehicle charging network right now. We have two federal grants to extend the geography of the network beyond the totality central Willamette Valley portion out into to the south on I-5 and into the coast into the mountains and up the gorge. And in the contracts, we have a provision for the providers that ODOT will be allowed to put in the equipment to capture the mileage reading, so that will happen naturally when they visit those stations. So we already have some forethought there, and it was very easy to put that in the provisions. With regard to the standards, you're absolutely correct. We have to be careful not to develop a whole set of standards on our own that will not integrate with the rest of the nation. That would make no sense. ODOT is hiring a team of experts, and they're hired through CH2M Hill, a local company, people that have worked in this field throughout the world, and others that I really can't talk about now because we're involved in contract negotiations. I would say that you'll regard them as a world-class team at the point that I can reveal them. But what they know are the existing standards for various elements of this, national and international standards for the various technologies involved here. Now, there may be a gap or two. And that's where ODOT may have to set the standard and be the standard bearer. But that is not the objective, is to have a single ODOT Oregon standard that everybody else has to live with. We know that the potential for charging by the mile is gaining acceptance nationally and in many, many states. And we may be the leader here in Oregon in the analysis. But we are very well aware that we have to integrate with the rest of the nation, and we want to do that very, very well. So I think I can assure you that this is not something we'll do willy-nilly on our own.
And this bill allows you to write those standards so that you can, which has the effect of allowing you to integrate with the rest of the country and the world around methods.
Yes, that's right.
Representative Barnhart and members of the committee, I'd like to add that the Federation of Tax Administrators, which Oregon is a member of, is very interested in this in their motor fuels section, because they all states are seeing the same pressure on fuels tax that Oregon is. And so they are very interested in looking at uniformity standards throughout the country as this federal highway. I just returned from a meeting with that group, and they're very interested in this concept as an adjunct to fuels tax revenues.
Just a quick comment on this issue. We're obviously not going to solve it this morning, but I'm sure that this committee and the Transportation Committee will be among those who are very, very interested in how the thing develops as you go along, and it may be a couple of years before you're able to tell us where you're going. If I may, a couple of other issues. And maybe they're related to the same kinds of questions. The information that you're likely to have about a vehicle would include the manufacturer specifications. Because you know what kind of vehicle it is. I mean, when it's identified, when the odometer is read, you have to have some way of identifying the vehicle. So you know what the weight of the vehicle is, and let me ask, I think it's a yes, no, or answer, or at least a simple answer. Would it be complex at that point, or difficult or impossible to differentiate between vehicles of different sizes and characteristics? If you told the programmers in your computer system to do that for the purpose of determining how much the mileage rate was going to be?
Chair Berger, Co-Chair Barnhart, I believe the answer to that is yes. That's something that we thought about years ago when we were investigating various...
Yes, it's not too complicated, or yes, it is too complicated?
Yes, these vehicles are already identified by type.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Benz is next, and then Representative Warren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to the why are we doing this now question, which came up a little bit yesterday, and just focus on the nature of what we're doing, having been designed as more or less a pilot project for the next 3 or 4 years, because that's kind of what it is. And what, why are we bothering with it again? Because that element seems to be slipping away, that why we're doing this. I mean, because some folks are saying, why don't we wait? And it seems to me that we're missing this opportunity that the electric cars provide us with, which is so clearly a situation where they're not getting 80 miles to the gallon, they're not even using the gallon. And so maybe you could just comment why we see this, those of us that served on your committee and also on the Transportation Committee, support starting now as opposed to waiting 3 or 4 more years.
Chair Berger, Representative Benz, there's really a couple of reasons. The Road User Fee Task Force was concerned with not having the vehicle owners of these electric vehicles get an expectation that they should drive for free. And if we wait for a long period of time, the expectation would grow. And so that's one reason to start early. The second reason is the more vehicles involved with a start means that it's more difficult and expensive to start the system. You have more people you're dealing with. We are going to do, if this bill passes, ODOT will be developing a new system based on existing knowledge, but still a new system. And you want to do that in a low-risk environment, which is fewer vehicles. If we wait, and this is a very important point, actually. You don't wait until ODOT figures it out. ODOT can spend some money on development, but it really takes a legislative directive for us to spend sufficient money to actually complete the system. And we won't spend a lot of money without that directive. So waiting means the system doesn't get started.
Yes.
Is there any reason that this mileage methodology is necessary for cars other than just the electric car? And my question is, of course, as we soon have cars that are getting 200 miles to the gallon, so is there a point at which the gallon isn't the proper measure of the wear and tear of the automobile on the road? That's my question. And is this an opportunity to get ahead of that process, which seems to be evolving with great rapidity?
Yeah. Chair Berger, Representative Benz, I think you hit it right on. The electric vehicles are simply the latest version of fuel-efficient vehicles, and we're going to see, we know of vehicles that are under development that will be highly fuel-efficient as well, and they're not covered by this bill. I think that it's important to recognize that vehicle classes may be added later, but it will be difficult to do so until there's more understanding of the system and how it will work, and that there is comfort with the collection system. So it's important to make the system known so that the legislature and the vehicle operators and owners can accept the change. Currently, we don't have the ability for them to accept it or for you to accept it because it's not known.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So is there one way of managing the situation and staying tied to the gallon would be to simply keep raising the gas tax? Just keep raising the gas tax. Ignore anything else other than just more money because there's fewer gallons being burned. Why don't we just use that technique?
Representative Berger, Chair Benz, you're going to have a fantastic stratification of society that way. And somebody ought to do a study of the impact on lower-income people who buy in the secondary and even tertiary markets for their vehicles and what that impact would be. The one thing we do know is that even the fuel-efficient vehicles cannot be produced at a sufficient rate for everyone to buy them quickly. It simply cannot happen. So the older vehicles will be in the marketplace. It turns 20 years to turn over a fleet, an entire fleet. So they'll be in the marketplace for quite some time. And to have increase the gas taxes to move the burden, and we don't exactly know where the burden would be moved. And that should be of great concern to, I think, this committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further? Representative Warren.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. A couple of questions. The 50%, 30%, 20% revenue carve-out, does that track with how we carve out the gas tax now?
Chair Berger, Representative Wan, yes. Not the old. This is evolved over time. The rate division has evolved over time, and this is the current version under the most recent arrangement with the gas tax increase. That's my understanding. So it's consistent with that.
Consistent with the increase or consistent with the whole gas tax that's being levied as of today?
Chair Berger, Representative Wan, the most recent arrangement with the 6 cents increase was 30, 50, 30, 20, and so it's in keeping with the most recent arrangement, not the entire history, but the most recent.
What's the arrangement with the base amount, not including the 6 cent increase?
I think this is a question for
better
Madison,
left. Yeah.
Who is our expert on distribution of gas tax?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate that.
Madison,
I haven't seen a gas tax that I can distribute. Representative Wan, as I will take you back to your
basic facts
packet.
The little Bible.
And in that.
Which page of the hymnal?
the distribution actually goes through different sections or different segments of the tax are distributed differently. And that is a thing of both history and also studies. The road task force of how and needs study distribute things differently. In the past, the distribution was 60-40 between cities, counties, on one side and the state, and or actually precisely 60.05 for the state, counties 24.38, and cities 15.57. Then came OTIA 1, and the OTIA 1 became 50-30-20. And then you had your bridge, which was OTIA 3, and it became 57.53, or that segment, 25.48, 16.99 for the cities. Then there was one of the things that we had with the plate fees at one point, and also the one of the things that we dealt with the, I don't want to say the number of the bill again, 2179 with the Silwood Bridge. The distribution for anything that happens within the counties is called the miscellaneous, and it'll be 60-40. House Bill 2001, everything else divides at 50-30-20. So there are that historic, and it's all in page H2 of your text back.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And last question for the panel, if I might, Madam Co-Chair.
Sure.
It's clear to me that we're talking about a real sea change in how we collect tax for roads. And I'm wondering if there is an analysis that I can look at that will show me how many employees it will require to bill, assuming 50% of the population, for example, of our state has an electric vehicle. Do we know how many employees we will have to hire? Do we know what the cost will be to administer that? Have we considered that as a part of this discussion? Because it seems once you head down this path, you're stuck, and billing companies for a weight mile tax that engage in long-haul trucking or chasing down gas station owners for a per-gallon tax is very, very different in kind from dealing with consumers, average folks who may be bankrupt or otherwise. So, thank you.
Representative, or Chair Berger, Representative Wan, We do have a fiscal on this, and that's the beginning point. We haven't done an estimate of a full government operation with 50% of the vehicles being electric. And in fact, we may not get to that point. The bill contains a provision whereby we may use the private sector to do some of these collection activities. And the reason for that is that we understand that the growth of government is not something that's considered favorable at the moment, and it may be difficult to get positions to do the job adequately. And so we have in Oregon something called the Oregon Innovative Partnerships Program, which allows for public-private partnerships. And we're very interested in using the private sector entities to not only collect or be involved with providing the technologies and collecting the data, but also payment services. Now, there'll always be a government option for that, because you have to have a way for those that bounce out of the private sector market a place to land. But the objective is not a large government bureaucracy for this. The objective is an efficient system that works well for the public.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from committee members for this panel? I'm sure that they'd be very happy to come to your offices if you have more technical things, as would about anybody, because this has been a fascinating discussion, and appreciate you coming. With that, I'm going to close. Where's my agenda? What's the number? Public hearing on 2328A and open a public hearing on 2550A. Chris is going to talk about this a little bit.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2550A expands the current intergovernmental reciprocal agreement between the Oregon Department of Revenue and the U.S. Financial Management Services and the IRS beyond tax revenues to include other federal payments.
Okay. That's pretty clear. Deborah Buchanan, would you like to come forward and why is this an A? Have we heard it before?
No, it just came from a different committee.
Oh, okay.
Good morning, Chair Berger. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. House Bill 2550 originated with a list of ideas that the department sent to a member last summer as to how taxes owed could be more effectively collected. And this is one of the bills that resulted from that. As Chris said, this would extend the current statutory authority that allows the department to enter into a reciprocal offset agreement with the federal government, and pursuant to that agreement, state tax debt can be offset against federal tax refunds, and federal tax debt may be offset against state tax refunds. That was enacted in 2001, and over the last several years, there have been about $13 to $15 million in state collections from that federal offset program. This bill, as was stated, expands that to include non-tax debt. For example, a college graduate may have student loans that are delinquent and have been unpaid for several years. The university may assign that debt to the Department of Revenue to be collected. If this bill were in place, we could place that debt in the federal database. If that former student then enters into a contract with the federal government, for example, to thin timber and receives a contract payment from the federal government, that contract payment could offset the state debt before being paid to the debtor. So this that's basically the intent of this bill, and there is a fiscal on it. Of about $200,000, if the funding is not made available to the department, this is something that we would phase in over time. This gives us the authority to do it. It probably would take us several years, and I think we would probably do that as part of our core system replacement project and be ready to go. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Wand.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So when one of these other types of debt is assigned to the Department of Revenue, does that change the character of the debt with regard to whether it's dischargeable in bankruptcy or not?
Madam
and if
Chair,
you need to answer that offline,
Representative
that's okay.
Juan, I don't know, but I will get you that information.
Thank you. My concern is it just has to do with whether with a tax debt and a tax liability, it's treated differently in bankruptcy. It's non-dischargeable. I just want to make sure that we're not changing the character of other types of debt through this inadvertently. Appreciate your input on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Could that include traffic fines, other criminal fines, that kind of thing, if they were assigned to the department for collection?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes. It would be any account that currently could be assigned to what we call our other agencies accounts unit for collection, which I do believe includes some parking fines, I believe, from Multnomah County, but also it would be other state debt. So if there is a state criminal fine, for example, or a court fine, we do collect those once they're assigned to us.
Yes. Currently, you don't collect them from justice courts, so do you?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, we do the offset process. So if a justice court assigns a debt to that unit, it is available for offset against state tax debt.
Okay.
It would not be available to offset against federal tax debt because of federal limitations on what federal tax can go to pay at the state level.
Okay.
Under this bill, we would be able to take those, add them to the database, and then non-federal payments could offset those.
Now, if I understood correctly, and I think I did, it also goes the other direction. If there's a state tax refund and the federal debt is due, the feds could ask you for that money up to the amount of the debt.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes.
And
yes.
Are fees that we charge them for that service similar to the fees they charge us for going the other direction?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, it's my understanding that although the Oregon law permits for fees to be charged to the federal government is not obligated to pay the fees, and I don't believe that they do.
Okay.
So there is a fee for putting the state debt into the database, and that is collected from the debtor. So the debtor does eventually pay for the cost of that offset.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious in the confidentiality issues. How do each system find out about the availability of the fund, so to speak? Because you're going to work an offset, you've got to know that there's something owed by the federal government. Let's take federal government owes someone in Oregon money. Somehow we find out about it. How does that happen?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, the federal law that was passed in 1996, I believe, required that federal payors obtain the tax identification number of the person who's to receive the payment, and then that goes into the database. The state would also have taxpayer identification number on the debt. So there's a matching process that's done, and when there's a hit, then the offset would occur.
Yes? We have someone in the department that checks the hits, or they show up on a hit list, or something happens. What happens?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, the debt comes into the agency, to our department, and is put into a database currently, and if there is a state refund available to that debtor, that refund matches up with the debt, and a portion is kept and paid to the assigning agency. With this program in place, that same process would happen where the debt then is assigned to the federal database, and if there's a match, then the federal payment would offset against the state debt.
Yes.
Not a follow-up. So the reason I ask the question is certain folks, let's say, that have a contract with the Forest Service to do firefighting may have assigned that contract to a bank, borrowed against it for firefighting equipment, and they're expecting the check, and all of a sudden it doesn't show up because there's been this offset worked. who wins the argument about priority?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, I don't know who wins that argument. I do know that we are required to provide notice to the debtor at least 30 days in advance that we may assign this debt to the federal database. It also has to be a liquidated and delinquent debt, so all rights of appeal have expired. We also need to give them the opportunity to pay the debt before the offset happens. As far as the priority, that I don't know.
One final follow-up. Yes. So just as to far as tax refunds go, that is understandable. The overpayment refunds and vendor payments, that expansion would raise this issue. That's why I find it of interest. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. And because Oregon's a non-community property state, and we often have Oregon joint filers with refunds available, how does this limit an innocent spouse in this case for their share of the liability? How are they protected from the other joint filers' liabilities out there?
Madam Chair, Representative Brewer, if we take too much money in the offset, then there is a process for the as you said, the innocent spouse to object to that, and the money would be refunded to that person.
Yes.
Thank you. So is that a rebuttable position? I mean, what's the procedure? How in-depth do they have to go? Do they have to prove? I mean, what's the benchmark there? How far do they have to go to get their money back?
Representative Berger, Chair Berger, Representative Brewer, we do have a process that's set up. We have administrative rules and then also a form that the innocent spouse can fill out and provide to us. It's, I think, not a very difficult thing to do. So we generally look at the tax return, see who earned the income, who had the withholding attributable to which wages, and work with that. Thank you.
I guess my only thank you, Madam Chair. My only concern with this is I'm not sure on the expansion of the debts being there, and that this you can't just always look through to the withholdings for the liability. For example, estimated payments may come from a joint account, and who participated in funding that joint account, things like that, and so. I like where this is going. I'm not bothered by where this is going as much as I want to protect in the joint filing position the non-debtor spouse and their contribution to it. And maybe you can speak to that a bit more as we expand the population of debts that can reach into the refund.
Madam Chair, Representative Brewer, perhaps it would help if I got you that form that we use and the instructions and show you the process that we go through now to ensure that there's some protection for an innocent spouse in those situations. I'd be glad to do that.
Thank you. That may get me partly there, but I still have some other concerns. It's because of the expansion of the universe of debt.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to think that through a bit.
Okay.
Thank you. Could you give us an idea of what the order of magnitude is of the current rule in terms of the dollars that it collects?
The Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, in the 2009 calendar year, statistics provided by the federal government were that almost $14 million came in from the Treasury Offset Program, which has been in place since 2001. And prior to that, it was $14 million. 2008, it was $15 million. There was a kicker year there, which I think bumped it up significantly. Perhaps about $5 million was collected from kicker checks going out that offset debt. I would not expect similar numbers from this expansion because it is limited to the accounts that are assigned. The expansion includes the accounts assigned to us by other agencies. And to see numbers closer to what other states experience, I think we need to expand it even further to include, for example, vendor payments by Department of Administrative Services. DAS contract payments to vendors would not be included in this program. So our experience likely won't compare to what other states have seen. Three other states have been in this for several years. Maryland, I believe, New Hampshire or perhaps New Jersey, but states on the East Coast where there are probably a lot more federal contract payments being made.
Mm. Okay. Thank you.
Another reason why.
Well, it really is helpful to get some sense of the order of magnitude of what we're talking about. So you're talking about a few million dollars a year, probably.
Probably.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Further questions for Deborah? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to come in and talk about this issue? No one's rushing forward, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2550A and adjourn this morning's Revenue Committee meeting. Have a good weekend.